today on Against the Grain. In the eyes of the Marxist thinker Rosa Luxemburg, the mass strike lay at the center of revolutionary strategy. What did Antonio Gramsci, another radical theorist, think of the mass strike and of revolution? I'm C.S. We'll re-present a conversation with the sociologist Daniel Egan about Luxemburg, Gramsci, and several other thinkers and debates coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What would it take to bring down capitalism? That question preoccupied two of the most interesting and incisive thinkers the Marxist tradition has ever produced, Rosa Luxemburg and Antonio Gramsci. For Rosa Luxemburg, who was born in Poland and moved to Germany at the turn of the 20th century, the mass strike stood at the core of revolutionary strategy. The Italian theorist Antonio Gramsci believed that a long, protracted struggle was necessary to topple capitalism. Did that mean that Luxemburg and Gramsci were at odds, that their notions of revolutionary strategy were incompatible? What Gramsci wrote about Luxemburg's theory of the mass strike suggests fundamental differences, and yet, Daniel Egan has recently argued that Luxemburg's theory of the mass strike is consistent with Gramsci's emphasis on protracted struggle. Egan is professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell, and he's the author of The Dialectic of Position and Maneuver, Understanding Gramsci's Military Metaphor. To last July's issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy, he contributed an article entitled Rosa Luxemburg and the Mass Strike, Rethinking Gramsci's Critique. When Daniel Egan joined me recently via Skype, I began by asking him what Edward Bernstein, a political theorist and member of the German Social Democratic Party in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, what Edward Bernstein argued about how Germany should move from capitalism to socialism.
Well, he saw that process as a very evolutionary one, that as capitalism developed, as capital became more concentrated, more centralized, as the proletariat grew in keeping with that development of capital, that the institutions of what would be the socialist society would be growing within capitalism. So trade unions would grow, become more influential, would take on some political power, cooperatives, that is, enterprises which were managed by workers, owned by workers or owned socially, would come to replace the capitalist corporation. And so there was, Bernstein sort of rejected the idea that there needed to be any kind of revolution or revolutionary politics. The Social Democrats would play a very important role in trying to get legislation passed that would improve conditions for workers, better pay, better working conditions, and so on. But that ultimately capitalism would grow into socialism. And so there was no need for a explicitly revolutionary party whose task would be to kind of see that process through.
And so working within parliamentary structures, this reform-oriented change that Bernstein was seeking, was this kind of a formal position taken by the German Social Democratic Party? Did they stand with him on this position?
Well, I think it was the subject of considerable debate. So Bernstein has this very evolutionary model. Karl Kautsky, in many ways, I think has a lot of similarities with Bernstein, but ultimately, I think he sees some kind of decisive struggle that would be necessary for the transition from capitalism to socialism to occur. That is, it would not be a kind of peaceful evolutionary growing into the development of trade unions, the Social Democrats in parliament, that as they grew in economic and political power, at some point there would be a break. That would be the that would be the revolutionary moment. So I think Kautsky had a more stronger understanding of the necessity for there to be some organization that was moving this process along. You know, the extent to which that was actually taken up by the Social Democrats, I think, is another question. But I think there was a lot of debate going on within the party. And then when you bring in Rosa Luxemburg, right, there's another sort of voice within the Social Democrats about the relevance of a party and the relevance in the importance of having a revolutionary strategy.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about Rosa Luxemburg's stance vis-a-vis Kautsky a bit later on, but in relation to Bernstein and his argument about kind of the gradual transformation of capitalism into socialism, what was her critique? What did she not agree with about what Bernstein was putting forward?
Well, I think for her, it just simply was a kind of negation of socialism. It was not, at its most fundamental, it was not socialist because Bernstein's vision was not the result of like a self-organization, the collective activity of the working class. It left the development of socialism to is kind of evolutionary laws of economic and social development. And so, Luxemburg's idea of socialism just was so fundamentally different.
To understand Rosa Luxemburg's notion of revolution and revolutionary strategy, we need to understand what she meant by the mass strike. And the mass strike is, of course, a key focus of your article. So what concretely did Luxemburg mean by the mass strike? I mean, when we hear about mass strikes, let's say in Europe, we think about transport workers going on strike, workers in other industries going on strike, maybe in sympathy with the transport workers, basically like an effort to shut down a city, for example, for a day. Is this what Rosa Luxemburg meant by the mass strike?
Well, I think it's it would be an illustration on a very kind of preliminary way of the mass strike. What Rosa Luxemburg was trying to distinguish with the concept of the mass strike was strikes that were not kind of narrowly based on economic demands, that were not narrowly geographically or industrially, but strikes that cut across the working class and that, while seeking economic changes, also sought important political changes as well. And so mass strikes are strikes that I think fundamentally are about the issue of power, in contrast to economic strikes, in which the basic power structure of capitalism remains intact and workers and capitalists are struggling over how much of the surplus goes to whom. What the mass strike does is it begins to open up possibility of a different type of politics. And also in terms of its organization, I think the mass strike is important because as workers involved in the mass strike, this is like how people experience the very earliest shoots of socialism and workers' sort of self-management of society in terms of collectively making decisions about how the strike goes, about demands. This is a sort of concrete place where worker self-activity is demonstrated. And Rosa Luxemburg saw these events, even when they did not, succeed in any strategic sense. She saw these as events in which the working class acquired more experience, more skill in terms of running affairs, and that these were all prerequisites for the ultimate victory of socialism over capitalism. You can't wait until after the revolution for the great mass of people to have the desire and the skills and the energy and the dedication to serve as the new ruling class.
Did Luxembourg see mass strikes as being kind of highly organized, or did she see them as arising without a lot of prior organization?
Well, I think this is an important question because it gets at, you know, the dialectical relationship between sort of a mass strike and a party. She was very clear that you cannot organize a mass strike in the sense that you can't dictate, you know, that this is going to happen. Mass strikes occur spontaneously in the sense that they emerge as a kind of spontaneous expression of sort of structural contradictions and crises of capitalism. But she also recognized the importance of a political party that could sort of help prepare the ground for those types of events, those types of breaks. The party and mass strike were not opposites. She saw them as sort of this dialectic of spontaneity and organization.
That's Daniel Egan. He's professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. We were talking about his article, Luxembourg versus Gramsci and the Mass Strike, which appeared in the July 2019 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You write that the Russian Revolution of 1905, not 1917, but of 1905, established for Rosa Luxemburg the significance of the mass strike for revolutionary strategy. Can you talk about that?
Well, partly, I mean, she's there. I mean, she's in Poland and part of the Russian Empire. And so she has some direct experience of that revolution. But also, 1905, both for Luxembourg and Lenin, you know, provided really important lessons for subsequent events. What 1905 showed was the importance of a kind of spontaneous movement of the working class, but then also showed its limits, right? If it was just limited to spontaneity and did not have a kind of leadership, some way to take that creative energy and apply it in a more strategic way. And so when you get to 1917, I think the circumstances are different, but also then in Russia, having had the experience of 1905, I think the Bolsheviks really benefited from that experience in shaping their strategy, you know, after February, between February and October 1917.
You referred earlier to Edward Bernstein and his notion of incremental reform leading to socialism, leading from capitalism to socialism. You also mentioned Karl Kautsky, another prominent Marxist thinker, theoretician, and how he thought about revolution as requiring some sort of a break, that there was some sort of decisive revolutionary struggle that needed to be waged against the capitalist elites. Did Kautsky think the mass strike, what did he think of the mass strike, and when a mass strike would be appropriate, would be called for, would be effective?
He was supportive of a mass strike at that decisive moment. And that was one of the criticisms that Rosa Luxemburg leveled against Kautsky, that this idea that you can pick up the mass strike as a tool, as an instrument, and that a political party which has not prepared the working class for such an event in which the working class has not been involved in its own organization, developing its own sort of skills. That a mass strike at that decisive moment without that long process of preparation would be a failure. So there was specific, I think it was the 1905 Congress of the Social Democratic Party, where they accepted the use of the mass strike for defensive purposes only. I think in terms of protecting voting rights in the event that the German state were to launch another attack on those. But Kautsky did not see the mass strike as relevant for the protracted process of revolution itself. He thought that it was more relevant for Russia, for countries that were less advanced in their capitalist development, and did not think that the mass strike as a general strategy would work in Germany. It was at most to be a tactic, again, at that decisive moment.
What did Rosa Luxemburg think of Kautsky's opinion that a mass strike is appropriate only in kind of, as you said, a country that is not advanced, that is more, quote, backward, as Kautsky thought Russia was in 1905?
Rosa Luxemburg makes the argument that the mass strike is relevant for Germany precisely because it is, at that time, an advanced level of capitalist development. Large capitalist enterprises bringing together large segments of the proletariat. You have the experience of sort of parliamentary representation, which at the same time, that it has provided German workers with some concrete benefits, it also reveals the limits of a kind of purely parliamentary strategy for achieving socialism. And she saw, the mass strike as being relevant in a period of in which capitalism was imperialist, right? The development of monopoly capitalism. It was for her in the most advanced areas of capitalism that the mass strike was most likely. And in fact, Russia was, although Russia in 1905 played a very important role in Rosa Luxemburg's understanding, she notes that the mass strike, earliest mass strikes that she makes note of, take place in Western Europe and in the United States.
And let me just ask you to elaborate a little bit on the role of the party in the eyes of Rosa Luxemburg and the party's role in mass strikes. So the party, according to Rosa Luxemburg, was it the responsibility of the party to actually call these mass strikes to kind of determine when the appropriate time was for such an action and to call people out into the streets or to urge them to effect this fundamental refusal of capitalism?
No, this is not something that the party could initiate. There is the objective conditions that lead to this spontaneous explosion of energy. What the party does is, in the lead up to that, in the time before that, the party is helping to build, to strengthen the working class, to build a kind of capacity so that when that moment occurs, the workers' movement can make the most of it. And when the mass strike is going on, the party plays an important role in helping, sort of to develop a strategy to try to link up these kind of spontaneous explosions in different, perhaps different parts of the country, a way to kind of centralize that energy. But the party does not, for Rosa Luxemburg, the party can't organize or dictate when this uprising will happen, when this mass strike will happen.
That's the voice of Daniel Egan. He teaches sociology at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Let's move to Gramsci, and you put Gramsci in a kind of conversation with Rosa Luxemburg in this article you've written in the journal Socialism and Democracy. Let's start this way. Gramsci identified two levels of what is, you know, in Marxist lexicon called superstructure. One is political society, and one is civil society. Can you describe both of those levels and also maybe give us a brief thumbnail, a definition of superstructure?
By political society, Gramsci's talking about, he often associates that with domination, coercive power, talking about the role of the state as the enforcer of bourgeois laws, ensuring that the working class does not step outside of its role as labor power for the bourgeoisie. Civil society is sort of a much broader concept that, in short, is a kind of cultural forms of power. The way in which the bourgeoisie and institutions of capitalist society help to shape consciousness, to try to eliminate any sort of space of where any kind of challenging thought can occur, through religion, through family, through schools. I mean, this is one of the areas where Gramsci, you know, Gramsci's influence over the past couple of decades is really strong, because you can use Gramsci to understand all kinds of social institutions because they sort of fall within that rubric of civil society. But in civil society, the idea is to win the consent of the proletariat to the rule of the capitalist class. So here is where a collection of values, symbolic meanings, which try to win over workers. And that implies that there has to be some space, some kind of negotiated process here. I don't mean that in a formal sense, but the capitalist class has to take into account, at some level, has to take into account the interests of the working class. And Gramsci's really clear that this happens only at a very kind of economic corporate level, in the sense that it may be about providing a particular level of wages, working conditions, some commitment perhaps to some general liberal democratic values. But ultimately, those concessions through which civil society operates can never touch the fundamental source of power, which is the bourgeoisie's control over capital.
What comprises political society and civil society? So we're talking about like law, courts, police, media, schools, religion. This all is part of the quote superstructure, because it's considered outside the economic base, right? The economic engine or mechanisms of society. That's how superstructure would be defined.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's an excellent question, because base and superstructure have, you know, after Marx and Engels used this term, and then later on Engels says, oh, you know, people have misunderstood us. We didn't mean that the superstructure is simply kind of built atop of, or is a reflection of, the base, that it has some level of autonomy of its own, at the same time that ultimately it is reinforcing capitalist power. One of the strengths, I think, of Gramsci's Marxism and his criticism of economism is the way in which he integrates economics and culture. So when he writes about Americanism and Fordism, it's economic and it's cultural at the same time, right? He's not separating out the sort of cultural aspects of Fordism about the management of workers' private lives to ensure proper hygiene and proper practices, which shapes them as workers, but also then, so in a cultural sense, shapes them as workers, but also facilitates their contributions to production of surplus value. And so Gramsci captures that dialectical relationship between base and superstructure that I think Marx and Engels presented, but which, you know, became kind of fetishized. And partly that has to do with, you know, the effects of, you know, Stalinism, Soviet Marxism, but also in various types of, you know, academic Marxism, there's still, you know, there had been this history of seeing the two as separate. But Gramsci, I think, gets around that. I think it's one of his real strengths.
You know, we've been circling around so many concepts that have to do with and realities that have to do with hegemony. But can you boil down Gramsci's notion of hegemony and how important it was for him that some sort of counter hegemonic revolution take place to take down the capitalist order, the hegemonic capitalist order?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Hegemony is the form of power that is expressed through civil society. So it's that power that shapes our sense of reality, our sense of our place in society. It shapes our expressions of class, our experiences of class. And again, with the goal of winning people over so that workers may experience, you know, are likely to experience their work as alienating and degrading and demoralizing and so on. But through the institutions of civil society, through this hegemonic power, they see a solution as being starting their own business, or they conclude there's nothing you can really do, or, you know, there are all kinds of individualized, more fragmented, atomized solutions. And that's one of the things that hegemony does. It glosses over sort of fundamental class differences and redefines them in ways that are less threatening to the reproduction of capitalism.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Daniel Egan, he teaches sociology at the University of Massachusetts Lowell, is my guest. His books include The Dialectic of Position and Maneuver, Understanding Gramsci's Military Metaphor. We are talking about an article he wrote about Rosa Luxemburg and Antonio Gramsci, two prominent, almost iconic Marxist thinkers. He wrote this article about especially how Gramsci viewed Luxemburg on the issue of the mass strike, and you can find that article in the July 2019 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. And we're going to move to how Gramsci thought about revolution and revolutionary strategy and where he thought Luxemburg's mass strike fit within that, or whether it fit at all. And I'd like to begin with this question of revolution according to or is envisioned by Gramsci. So you have this hegemonic power, and it's being reinforced and produced and reproduced by civil society, as you said, by the institutions of civil society, which exist to produce and enforce a kind of consent among the governed, consent to being governed by these capitalist elites. So how would this counter-hegemonic revolutionary strategy work? Like, how important was it for Gramsci that there be a radical break with this hegemony? And how did he envision it playing out?
Gramsci argued that in the more sort of advanced capitalist countries, which had a more fully developed civil society, a revolutionary strategy that is focused on the seizure of the state, that is, the seizure of political society, will ultimately fail because it is not attacking this fundamental form of bourgeois power. And so the revolution has to be this kind of protracted process in which a counter-hegemony, a kind of counter, I don't want to say counter-culture because that has all kinds of connotations, but a culture based on solidarity, based on liberation, based on the elimination of oppression and exploitation. Again, you can't wait until after the revolution to create that. So a counter-hegemonic revolution is one that is trying to build that alternative culture, the culture that would be necessary for a socialist system. That's the key to the revolutionary process. Now, at some point, Gramsci is not saying that what he calls the war of maneuver, that it is a more kind of insurrectionary or mass strike type of event. He's not saying it's not important anymore in the West, but it is definitely kind of secondary. The revolution will be won or lost to the extent that a counter-hegemonic power can be established.
If the war of maneuver, as theorized by Gramsci, is sort of this insurrectionary break, what then did he see, or what did he call the kind of war that needed to be waged against the capitalist system? And where did he see Rosa Luxemburg's mass strike fitting into either of those two categories?
The strategy that he presents, his counter-hegemonic strategy, is a war of position. It is a protracted struggle. It is, think of it as a kind of form of siege warfare, right? If the war of maneuver is a head-on attack against the enemy, identifying the weak point in the enemy's forces and striking there, war of position is siege warfare. It will take a long time. And so what he saw the mass strike, when he talks about Rosa Luxemburg and the mass strike, he's presenting the mass strike as if it is this kind of momentary explosion. And this is precisely the kind of the understanding of the mass strike that Kautsky had and was opposed to, but very different from Rosa Luxemburg's sense of the mass strike, which she saw as being this protracted struggle. But he uses Rosa Luxemburg's concept of the mass strike, right, to differentiate the war of maneuver from the war of position. And he sees the war of position as being this much slower, sort of more patient process of cultural development. I think Rosa Luxemburg's concept of the mass strike completely encapsulates what Gramsci's talking about with his war of position, that it is a process that requires this kind of slow development of revolutionary consciousness, of worker self-organization, self-activity. I see the two as being very similar, except there seems to be some, difference in terms of how, where Gramsci places the mass strike in his war of maneuver, war of position dialectic.
Yeah, so if I get this right, if maybe in your opinion, Gramsci had properly classified or understood what Rosa Luxemburg meant by the mass strike, which it was, as you said, a process, part of a protracted struggle, he might have then said, oh, and actually this is part of the war on position, the war of position, and this is what I'm advocating. And so I agree with Rosa in this regard.
I'm not sure if it's a question whether he, didn't understand Rosa Luxemburg fully. I mean, there is this, in the prison notebooks, language is very important to Gramsci in a variety of ways. And he identifies Rosa Luxemburg with this Kautskyan idea of the mass strike. He also, and I think this is a kind of a parallel issue, he also identifies Leon Trotsky as a proponent of the war of maneuver. I think that's just, completely wrong. If you look at Trotsky's body of work, particularly when he was in the Communist International, he very clearly is supportive of a united front strategy. This is something that would take a very long time to develop. But he associates Trotsky with war of maneuver and sort of uses that as a kind of a way to kind of surreptitiously critique Stalinist third period policies in the Comintern, which were about, capitalism has reached a stage where there's a decisive break, and so now it's time to launch these insurrections. Identifying Trotsky with that argument, it's factually incorrect, but it serves as a kind of a stand-in where perhaps he couldn't say explicitly he's articulating criticism of the Communist International. And I think the same thing's going on with his comments on Rosa Luxemburg. His representation of Rosa Luxemburg, again, it's closer to Kautsky, it's closer to Comintern criticism of Rosa Luxemburg as being too, economistic, emphasizing spontaneity too much, not taking into account the important role of the party. And these are things that, again, were not good representations of Luxemburg's argument, but they can serve as a surrogate for Gramsci to criticize Communist Party policy. So I don't think he didn't understand fully Luxemburg's take on the mass strike. There's a strategic logic, I think, to how he uses Rosa Luxemburg.
And just to clarify the terminology Daniel was using, the Comintern, the Third International, the synonyms, that was the association of communist parties of various countries formed to kind of coordinate the world communist movement. And my guest is Daniel Egan, professor of sociology at UMass Lowell. And again, we're talking about an article he wrote about Rosa Luxemburg and Antonio Gramsci, the German radical, the Italian communist. He's written a book, by the way, about Gramsci called The Dialectic of Position and Maneuver. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. How did Gramsci think about the role that the party, that the political party, that the Socialist or Communist Party plays or should play in mass revolutionary action? And how would you compare that with Luxemburg's view on the same issue?
Gramsci talks about the necessity for a modern prince, that is, some collective agent that can provide leadership in revolution. Gramsci was very much opposed to a kind of mechanical kind of centralism, bureaucratic centralism. He advocated a much more democratic form of centralism. It was very clear when Gramsci talks about the party, he's talking about an agent whose job is to eliminate itself as the working class develops its own skills, its abilities to rule, you don't need the party anymore. So it's there's a sense in which Gramsci's sense of the party is that it'll ultimately sort of commit suicide if it does its job right. He talks, and this comes from one of his earlier writings. He talks about the importance of a vanguard party. He saw in 1919, 1920, what happens when kind of spontaneous worker uprisings in Italy lacked any kind of political leadership. So the workers in Turin, for example, they seize the factories, they establish worker councils, and the Italian Socialist Party steps away. And one of the reasons why that movement failed was because of the lack of leadership. So Gramsci was often used as a foil with Lenin, right? Lenin talks about a vanguard party, very centralist, bureaucratic. Gramsci does not. Gramsci talks about a vanguard party, but he uses that term very specifically. He talks about a vanguard party, but a vanguard with armies. So it's not this isolated vanguard that sees itself as the agent of revolution or the agent of the transition to socialism. The vanguard has this army behind it, and the vanguard is tied sort of organically to that army. So I think Gramsci very much sees the importance of a party, and in that light, he's very much like Rosa Luxemburg, who, all the while she's talking about the importance of the mass strike, she doesn't leave the Social Democratic Party. She stays there. And that reflects how important party was. And then when she ultimately does leave, becomes one of the founders of the Spartacist League, which in turn becomes the base out of which the German Communist Party develops. There again, you have this recognition that mass action and a political party are not contradictory. That in fact, mass action, mass revolutionary action from below requires some type of agent to provide that kind of leadership.
We've been talking about some deep theoretical insights, two very important thinkers, mostly operating in the early 20th century, Antonio Gramsci and Rosa Luxemburg. What can we take today from these two thinkers on this issue of the mass strike, of this idea of a protracted struggle on both the economic and political front? What can we learn from them about how to wage our struggles against capitalism, how most effectively to attack it and to possibly bring it down?
Well, I think a great example, I think, of what Rosa Luxemburg was talking about were the teachers' strikes of the past couple of years in a number of states. These were strikes that were not simply about wages and working conditions for teachers. They brought allies, students, parents, other unions, community organizations. So there was a really mass base to that type of protest movement. And at the same time, these were strikes that were in many ways calling very fundamental structures of 21st century capitalism into account. The teacher strikes were about what education should look like and the extent to which education has been subject to the deep austerity of neoliberal policies of the past couple of decades, the growing kind of commodification or marketization of education. And so these are the kinds of themes that take you, beyond what are usually seen as kind of more narrow local economic demands of a strike. I think that's precisely the kind of thing that she was talking about. And it also goes a long way to, the link with those types of strikes with Gramsci as well, because these are cultural struggles as much as they are labor struggles. And that gets at Gramsci's non-economistic sense of revolution. It gets at trying to construct a counter hegemony to present a kind of different worldview about how education should be organized. So I think we've seen sort of expressions, even if relatively undeveloped, but we've seen expressions of the kinds of counter hegemonic struggles or protracted mass strike struggles that both Gramsci and Luxembourg talked about.
You also bring up in this article this issue of inevitability. Did not Rosa Luxemburg speak about the mass strike as inevitable?
She did. And this would be a point of contrast to Gramsci, because Gramsci has a much more contingent view of history. But I think in arguing that the mass strike is inevitable, I guess my interpretation of it is that not inevitable in the sense of it will happen, but inevitable in the sense that the sort of political economy of advanced capitalism produces the contradictions and the stresses and the forces that would make the mass strike possible. But by themselves, those forces will not make the revolution. She writes somewhere about, you know, history has done its job, now it's your turn. Right, the historical inevitability of mass strikes has developed with the development of advanced capitalism, but now the working class, through their organizations and activity, they're the ones who will make that mass strike real.
Something you write in this piece, Daniel, about Luxembourg is, I think, your understanding or your perception that the people don't pay enough attention to Luxembourg's work and ideas today. Did I get that right? And if that's true, or if that's your perception of things, why not? Why is her work relatively marginalized as compared with other people's work, like Gramsci's?
Well, I think Gramsci provides an interesting example of what happens sometimes when a sort of Marxist theorist becomes more and more influential. There's a kind of watering down. And so I think one of the problems with much discussion of Gramsci is the way in which the idea of, you know, some kind of decisive moment of conflict, it is deemed to be so far in the future that we don't even have to think about it. And I think that's a fundamental misreading of Gramsci. But I think that in watering down Gramsci to make him more widely accepted, I think you lose a lot of the power. I don't know how you can talk about Gramsci without talking about the modern prince or the party, but Gramsci gets used as a way to justify doing away with any notion of party. So I think there are things about Gramsci that have made it easier to kind of incorporate Gramsci's work, certainly into academia and to other fields. I think it's harder with Rosa Luxemburg, precisely because of the concept of the mass strike as being seen as this kind of explosion. I think that oftentimes it's easier to leave those uncomfortable aspects or more uncomfortable aspects of a theorist alone. Another example of this, and you know, is Frantz Fanon. Fanon is used all over. I've used Fanon in some of my work, incredibly important, but there's this way in which a lot of discussions about Fanon just simply ignore the discussion about violence, as like it was only relevant at that historical period, and how can we make use of Fanon without that kind of uncomfortable question? Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that shapes how widely accepted certain theorists become.
Daniel Egan, professor of sociology at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. And we've been talking about his article, Luxembourg versus Gramsci and the Mass Strike. You can find that in the July 2019 issue of the journal Socialism and Democracy. The article draws from Daniel's book. It's called The Dialectic of Position and Maneuver, Understanding Gramsci's Military Metaphor. Dan, thanks so much for your work, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate you having me on.
And in the couple minutes we have remaining, I'd like to read a bit of Rosa Luxemburg. It's always good, I think, to hear from the thinker, her or himself. This is what Luxembourg wrote in 1906. It is absurd to think of the mass strike as one act, one isolated action. The mass strike is rather the indication, the rallying idea, of a whole period of the class struggle lasting for years, perhaps for decades. Every new onset and every fresh victory of the political struggle is transformed into a powerful impetus for the economic struggle, extending at the same time its external possibilities and intensifying the inner urge of the workers to better their position and their desire to struggle. After every foaming wave of political action, a fructifying deposit remains behind from which a thousand stalks of economic struggle shoot forth, and conversely. The workers' condition of ceaseless economic struggle with the capitalists keeps their fighting energy alive in every political interval. It forms, so to speak, the permanent fresh reservoir of the strength of the proletarian classes, from which the political fight ever renews its strength, and at the same time leads the indefatigable economic sappers of the proletariat at all times, now here and now there, to isolated sharp conflicts, out of which public conflicts on a large scale unexpectedly explode. Words written by Rosa Luxemburg and quoted by Dan Egan in his article in Socialism and Democracy. And that program first aired on March 3rd of this year. And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.